Hi, Kelvin.
Hi.
Here we are already in the third part of your, let's call it the expose, on how Tetrionics came to understand gravity and how that works. We've already talked about how you didn't look for gravity, but discovered how it works by starting with the foundations of Tetrionics, which you've described in the first and second books. Basically having the mechanics and the dynamics which are associated with how Planck quanta work as units for creating the universe. In the previous section, you have already explained how we need to look in a different way than was done by Newton and Einstein and others. Where they were looking for a way to express what we see in the world around us, of the movement of masses and the relationships between them in what was then called gravity. From your perspective, you saw that you ended up with understanding gravity by coming to understand how Planck quanta interact. And you describe that basically when you start with a Planck quantum as described in Tetrionics in the form of the triangle, then when you combine triangles to form a tetrahedron, something very special happens, which is not just that you have triangles creating a tetrahedron, but also that the force fields balance out in such a way that the empty space is in a way shielded off from the environment. You call it like the equivalent of a Faraday cage, but as a result the emptiness within needs to be counteracted. It will evoke a counteraction from the environment of what we then now describe as the gravitational force. But in Tetrionics something totally different comes into view, which is that you understand how it is the charge fields associated with the triangles which combine in a different form, creating inductive loops and inertia and all kind of other effects which lead to a much deeper understanding of gravity than what the normal books describe. And you've already illustrated that you actually will end up with three different factors involved. But you also explained that in order to be able to clarify that, it is necessary to make a similar kind of distinction as which is required in setting apart mass versus matter, or the triangle versus the tetrahedron, but also that you can see that the triangle by its loop is actually a time base and a unit of time, and that the tetrahedron defines the unit of space as a standing wave. So in a way it seems as if you have made things much more complex, but when you look at the foundations from which you work, you can see that in actuality it's much more simple. Yes, it does require another way of thinking. Yes, it does require stepping outside of the model as it is customarily used for now, but then essentially anybody can follow in your footsteps and realizing that if you simply start with the principles of cutting out the templates of Tetrionics, putting them on the table, piecing them together, seeing what patterns it forms, then like you did, at some point you can realize what gravity is and how it works from that perspective. Quite amazing, Calvin.
It was many years in the evolution.
Yeah.
It's very easy to look at a finished product and say, oh, yes, that makes sense, and I can see the detail as well as the larger picture. But that belies just how much effort and thought went into discerning what was really going on. Of course, once you do, as you say, you can get a very simplistic and overall view of what's going on and develop and refine it as much as you want from that point onwards.
So how can we take it further? Because essentially you've already described that you need to start differently. You need to start from these premises of tetrionics, play with the triangles, make the tetrahedra, see how they all interconnect, and then you can come to a different way to understand what Newton, Coulomb, and Einstein and all those others try to bring together. For you, the bringing together was the consequence of basically playing with the pieces of the puzzle. And so how can everybody follow your next line of thought?
Okay, I'll just continue through as it's been laid out in the Tetrionics or Principia ebook 4, which is cosmology, quantum cosmology. And just as a quick recap, we've obviously covered empty space, spatial coordinates. 6308 would be a good starting point. We've now separated space from time. They are distinct things. One's a coordinate system. The other one's a measure of changing angular momenta within that coordinate system. Just as we've separated mass and matter from energy and each other, with mass being a form of energy per second and matter being a form of energy or mass energy topology per second squared. In tetrionics, you'll find that because we unfortunately have mass and matter both starting with M, tetrionics uses lowercase m for mass geometries and uppercase M for matter topologies. I further color code them as green for mass energies and blue for mass energies, green for matter topologies. That helps keep things organized, but the main differentiation is mass is differentiated by matter, just like geometry is differentiated by or from topologies. So we've covered that, and then 6309 simply summarizes that the fact that no matter whether it's mass or matter, it's a form or even a force, it's a form of energy within a spatial region, and that energy forms an impedance. Electrical engineers tend to think of impedance as a resistance, something that slows down the velocity of propagation, which is quite correct. Tetrionics takes a similar but slightly different view. It sees it as where the energy fields or energy geometries overlap. It creates an impedance to the flow of photons or particles within that region. Just like if you add cornstarch to water, something will move through the water at a certain speed, a bit more cornstarch, it slows down a bit more until eventually it stops. It's just energy works the same way. The more energy you have in a field, or in a spatial region, I should say, the slower it will move. It will impede the progress. Normally, the impedance of or the energy within any spatial region in a vacuum is such that it creates a velocity of c for photons of energy. So we get the speed of light. Photons move at the speed of light in the vacuum. Physics these days, as it's taught, tends to teach students that the vacuum is empty, and that's not the case, as we discussed in the previous discussion. There is no such thing as an empty space except within matter. That's a different topic. The vacuum energy of any spatial region then determines how fast these photons move, and of course more energy in a spatial region of more mass, and that mass can also have a topology which is matter. So in the case of matter being water, it will slow down the speed of light because it has a different density. In the case of it being quartz, again, it will change the speed of propagation, resulting in light splitting into the spectra colors, because the energy density which makes up the matter topologies affects the impedance of any spatial region that matter or that anything, energy in any form, moves through it. Having said that, 6401 begins our explanation into exactly what is going on to create universal gravitation, all the forces. It compares two particles, two atoms, one being carbon and the other being lead. And it just shows you the physical topology of in this case carbon 12 versus an atom of lead. And then you, in that difference, you can see that mass is a mass energy is a completely different thing to matter. Matter is the topology, as we've discussed. It's the volume, the size, the three-dimensional component of an atom, whereas the mass energy, if you like, in the case of tetrionics, is simply the charged fascia, the Higgs bosons of each one. Each color-coded fascia that you can see there for both atoms has X amount, or roughly 1 by 10 to the 19, for the carbon N1 levels, Planck quanta. So for each charged surface you see there in a carbon 12 atom, which has 270,072 charged fascia, each charged fascia has 1 by 10 to the 19 triangles of mass energy. So the mass energy is the canvas, if you like, of the matter topology. The topology creates a volume. Mass energy gives it the weight, gives it the mass in a gravitational field. I'm just laboring on these points because they are important points as you get further into it. So tetrionics then summarizes it as we have two types of particles. Physics says we have fields and we have particles. Tetrionics in 6403 shows us the geometries of mass energy geometries, which are fields. They are planar, flat, equilateral triangles of Planck energy. If there's two of them, they're a photon. If it's odd numbers, they are bosons. And obviously, we also have a quantum of matter, which is a tetrion, which is what gives tetrionics its name. The tetrion is the smallest 3D quantum of matter that's possible. And more importantly, it's a quantum of gravitational matter. It has a 3D topology, and it displaces vacuum energies. And this is where we start getting into the nitty-gritty. The displacement of vacuum energies is key. 6408 summarizes up this displacement. It highlights the vacuum energies as red, and where matter, in this case a tetrion, is formed, you can have positive and negative tetrions, you can have neutral tetrions. But where the 3D topology of a tetrion is formed, it displaces the vacuum energy. The vacuum energy, in turn, pushes back, trying to equalize the region of null space that's created by this matter topology. Doesn't the amount of mass energy in that topology makes no difference at this point of understanding gravitation. It is strictly the topology that is important. It is that topology within any spatial coordinate system that has vacuum energies, and they all have, that creates the first force that we're attempting to describe here. It is the strictly convergent force of gravity. Gravitation is different to gravity. So in this illustration, you can see that the M, the capital M, represents exactly what Newton put in his formulas. And it also relates to the Einstein's equations, because the TAB, the tau AB, is the mass energy of the matter, as well as the mass energy of the vacuum energies. So Einstein couldn't differentiate between matter and mass energies. Tetrionics can. Newton never bothered. He just said a physical ponderable body, as he called them, has X amount of mass. Einstein went further and described the displacement forces, or the force that's created by the displacement of vacuum energies by matter, as the curvature, which is the left-hand side of his equation, which Wheeler summarized by saying matter tells space where to go and space tells matter how to move. That was his summary. It's accurate for the equations, but it's not quite the full picture. But this is the genesis of what is creating gravity. With tetrionics, we obviously, through the charges, we can create all the particles known that exist in the universe. 6409 has a simple proton. It has 48 charged fascia between the electron and the proton. And because the mass energies of those fascia form a topology, they will create weight in a gravitational field. It is the fact that they are in a topology, they are in matter. Matter is gravitationally attractive, not mass energy. So in order to be attracted via the convergent force of a pure gravity field, you need this topology, and that's what this illustration is demonstrating. Matter is associated with weight, whereas energy is weightless. You often hear of it referred to in relativity as being massless, and then a whole series of arguments starts up between the students and the professors, because photons have energy and they have momenta. If they have momenta, they must have a mass component. So they should not be called massless, but instead they are. Tetrionics resolves that by saying photons are mass energy geometries, but they are matterless or weightless particles. They don't have any topology, any Z component. They do not displace any vacuum energies. So therefore, they are not gravitational particles. But tetrions in every large particle that are built from tetrions are subject to gravity and do have a gravitational weight. So it's a very clear distinction made between the two. And that distinction becomes very important. 6410 then begins to show us what we have when we create a quantum of gravity, a tetrion. From the previous books, we know that fields of mass energy can form positive or negative charges. When we add energy of motion to particles, they form chem fields. We also have BEM fields for biological systems. But we show clearly that any quantum of matter has two properties. The first one is that it displaces vacuum energies to create a convergent gravitational force, or gravity force, I should say. The displaced vacuum energy will push back on the tetrion or any other atom from all angles as it seeks to equalize this volume of space that has been displaced. At the same time, any quantum of matter, tetrion upwards, has mass energies. Because it has mass energies, it will radiate EM fields, be they very low energy infrared right through to gamma rays. They have EM fields whose strength are determined by the mass energy of the matter topology, or the mass energy content of the matter topology. Those radiated EM fields, which I usually mark in blue, versus the green of gravitational fields, all act at once on any particle of matter. So, as a summary, you could say that a quantum of matter creates a convergent gravity field, and its mass energy content creates a radiant EM field. Together, these fields form a GEM field, a GEM, gravito-electromagnetic field, because there are convergent gravity forces and there are radiant EM forces that attract and repel. 6411, I won't go into a great deal of discussion about, but I will just point it out. It is the summary page that covers the definition of photons being weightless versus, or matterless, being versus massless particles. It shows the formulation for mass versus the formulation for matter in terms of energy per spatial coordinate. And it shows clearly that photons are not massless particles. They have mass energy, but they are matterless particles. And they are, because of that, they are weightless. The earliest formulations we discussed early on covered of matter in particular and gravity, and its matter's fields of force produced Newton's equations of gravity between neutral particles. And where we had charged particles, even if they were very similar, as drawn in illustration 6501, they were described using Coulomb's force equations. Tetrionics shows how that charge imbalance between those very similar particles arises, how they can form, how in both cases Coulomb's law and Newton's law, while they are mathematical, they can be redrawn as geometric equations, where the only difference between the geometry at work for the fields of force is simply the scaling constant, or the constant of interaction between the two objects. In that respect, tetrionics then explains why Coulomb's law of interaction is so similar to Newton's law of gravitation and why we've struggled with it. 6502 gives us a much better, or a more high level detail explanation of those two forces in geometric terms. It shows them as in terms of Coulomb's, the similarities of Coulomb's and Newton's equations for charge interaction and gravitational interaction or attraction, respectively, we find that we have equations that give us units of force of Newton meters squared per kilogram squared. The way tetrionics shows how that works is through two geometric mean fields of mass energy interacting. Now, this is where you get an insight into how the math came about for Newton in particular. What Newton did was, and this is why G is an relatively poorly measured constant at the moment versus Coulomb's constant, which is fairly well known and measured. Newton didn't know the masses of the Earth and the Moon. He knew the distances and he knew the velocities in proportion between the Earth and the Moon. So therefore he could calculate the force that had to be in place in order to keep the Moon in orbit around the Earth. You can simplify the mass of the Earth versus the mass of the Moon by simply drawing those respective masses as fields of mass energy, equilateral fields, or diamond-shaped fields, I should say, radiating from a single point. And you'll see that here in this picture, 6502. Doesn't matter whether it's a charged mass or a gravitational mass, makes no difference. The mass is drawn as a diamond-shaped field representing the strength. So even though these look similar, if it were, they'd be similar objects. If it were the Moon and the Earth, one field would be darker, or it would have a color scheme to indicate that its strength was less than the other. But what happens is, where those fields overlap, as drawn there, between the K and the G constants, you have a squaring of the forces produced by the Planck quanta in those fields. So, in this example, say they're identical, and say there were, I don't know, 16 Planck quanta. You would have 16 Planck quanta pointing one way to from one planet to the other, and 16 pointing back from one planet or one charge to the other. Where those fields overlap, the force vectors overlap, and if they were dead equal, they would cancel each other out. If there was an imbalance, obviously there would be a resulting force vector in one direction or the other towards the larger object that has more energy momenta in its field. In the case of electric fields, those fields are positive and negative charges, so they both attract and repel. In the case of gravitational fields, a hypothetical particle had to be dreamt up that was strictly convergent or strictly attractive, and that was termed the graviton. Even though it's a hypothetical particle or field, as it should be termed, it still performs the same role as an electromagnetic field. It's just hypothetical, and it gives the result that you're after. But the main point here is, even though there is a matter topology, as illustrated in the previous illustration for every particle, we can generalize those topologies as mass energy fields and calculate the interactions between those fields. 6503 does exactly that. It shows the difference between a graviton field, where the forces are strictly convergent, versus an electromagnetic field, where the forces can either attract or repel dependent on the charge of the main body and the body that it's interacting with. And that's the difference between Coulomb and Newton's laws. They're both, the reason why they are both similar is because they're both geometric means between two bodies. And the fields themselves just represent the mass or the charge content, remembering, of course, that mass is a measure of energy per second, charge is a measure of Planck quanta per second, giving us mass seconds, and that's the only difference between the two in a tetrionic sense. This is getting rather complex, but it's an important point. What Newton and what Coulomb did to describe the laws with their different vector forces but similar equations are fully accounted for in tetrionics using generalized equilateral fields of force with mass energy within those fields. Now, that's again all summarized by 6504 regarding the Newton's force and Coulomb's force. But of course, Newton couldn't explain his force. He could explain the observed results, and the results matched, the math matched the results, or vice versa, very accurately, and gave him confidence that he had discovered a universal form of mathematics that describes gravitation. Coulomb's force equation for charges is mediated by photons. Newton's couldn't be explained, so we created a graviton and began the search for gravitons. And this is where Einstein came into it. We now have to compare these superpositioned or superimposed equilateral mass energy fields that represent matter that work for Coulomb and Newton with these curved spacetimes that Einstein talks about. So we model them again in tetrionics as per 6505. As you've just seen, 6505 draws the, we're dealing with mass energies. At the top of the picture, we have two superpositioned mass energy fields representing two forms of matter, two sizes of matter, equal in this case. And the region of interaction between them is a gravitational field. It's why matter attracts matter. And it does so because of the Planck quanta in between, as per Newton and Coulomb's equations, irrespective at this stage of whether they're charged or not. Same fields apply. You'll see that in this case I've drawn spatial fields around those equilateral geometries, or around the diamond-shaped geometries, the superposition ones for Coulomb and Newton, because their mass energies, they're measured with a C-squared spatial field. So you've got the mass energy of matter, or charged matter, in both cases, within a C-squared field. And where those fields overlap, we have our field of gravitational attraction between the two forms of matter. In that case, the spatial fields are also superpositioned, which means they stop being C to the C squared, and they become C to the fourth, which mathematically is extremely fortuitous. Because in tetrionics, we measure matter in C to the fourth spatial coordinates, because we need the volume. By having superposition fields as C to the fourth and matter topologies as C to the fourth, it rationalizes out the spatial coordinate systems, so everything is in C to the fourth. If you see, you won't see C to the third coordinate systems, which are commonly shown in entropy work, in tetrionic work for gravitation, because C to the third, as we've discussed before, is a Cartesian coordinate system. We want everything in spherical coordinate systems. Spherical is a C to the fourth, and it just so happens that two superpositioned C squared fields for mass energy geometries is C to the fourth as well. So it rationalizes out beautifully. But the bottom half of that picture then takes us into Einstein's equations, where he represented mass, energy, and matter as the curvature of an energy density. So he took all the mass, energy, all the mass and matter and the energy of the system under measurement in a C4th system, as you'll note on the right-hand side, 8 pi g divided by c to the fourth. That was the coordinate system that that general relativity uses. By converting all the mass and matter into an energy density, we can draw it in a form of a contour. Highest density where the matter is centralized, where the center of matter is, or mass matter more appropriately, is located in both spaces, radiating outwards from the center of mass matter. Where the radiated fields overlap, again, creates a region of interaction, a gravitational region of interaction, which is identical to the one above. They are both identical representations. They're just a different form. You might say it finally shows the difference between Newton's mathematics and Einstein's geometric approach. One, Newton's was geometric square means. Einstein's was curved space-time, even though he failed to recognize what space-time really was. But we've now successfully united Coulomb and Newton and compared it directly to Einstein or general relativity. So we can have a direct comparison, which we've never been able to do before. You have the comparisons mathematically, but not geometrically. So what does that show us in terms of the fields of interaction about matter? Well, it shows us that we, as in 6506, we have both a gravitational field, which is probably best described using Einstein's curved space-time. It's the displacement of vacuum energies that we spoke about. Where matter is created, you have a displacement of vacuum energies, and that creates gravity, big G, as shown in that picture there. But on top of that gravity displacement, which is a fairly weak force, you have a stronger force, which is the electromagnetic force, which is radiated by all matter, dependent on its mass energy content. And now you're beginning to see why all attempts to describe or to develop unified quantum theories of gravity have failed, because they've never understood the role of mass and matter, and never differentiated between mass and matter and the physics that they create within a spatial coordinate system. Tetrionics does that because we're working with rigid geometries, not just mathematics. The geometry that forms has to give us the math that we're familiar with, and that's a checksum, if you like, that we're on the right track. If we're getting the right math answers, we're making sense and we're making progress. We've already done that by unifying Coulomb and Newton. Now all we have to do is explain how these three forces, the gravity force created by topological matter displacing vacuum energies, and the interactive forces created by their radiant mass energies within all matter, combine to give us a unified mechanics at all scales of physics that we can call universal gravitation. What has to be pointed out along the way, obviously, is that the strength of the gravitational constant, or the force created by matter displacing vacuum energies, is far weaker than the interactive forces created by radiant mass energies around matter. And that's what 6507 just quickly points out. I won't go into it, but simply G is far weaker in strength than K. That's why G has been hard to measure. G is still a relatively poorly defined constant at present. Tetrionics can define it far more accurately than anything else at the moment. So we've now got an accurate picture of what any region of space with mass and matter in it is going to do in the terms of physics, leaving alone motion, just a static piece of matter in a spatial field. We can see its topologies creating gravity. We can see its mass energies within that topology is creating a an interactive field that acts with the gravity to form universal gravitational fields. And when I speak of gravitational, I'm speaking of electric as well as gravitational. So just trying to find the next picture that's really good. There are some additional pictures you'll see in the ebooks that go into much more detail on the actual math that I've calculated out for the value of G versus the current estimate and the value of K. And you'll see it's very reflective. It comes out to actually reflect how many quanta are in the electron topology and that gives us an exact value for the gravitational constant, which, just out of curiosity, I'll see if I can find for you. No, I won't do that. It's only going to make it confusing if I start spouting numbers for you at the moment. The .66, the gravitational constant, as I mentioned, is the gravitational constant, so poorly measured and estimated constant at present. It's one of our worst known ones. Many people have measured it. Cavendish is probably the most famous for his first attempt. He simply wanted to weigh the Earth, so to speak. He wanted to refine Newton's work and build on it. He used a balance, a torsion balance, and you'll note in his work that he went to great lengths to exclude electromagnetic fields and any other forms of radiant energy, wind, all that sort of stuff from his apparatus, so as to get the most accurate possible measurement. But as I show here in the illustration, even though he excluded as much radiant energy from his experiment as possible, and even though we've tried to improve upon that same experiment, matter by definition is comprised of charged mass energies. It is how matter is formed. So therefore, any two forms of matter on a torsion bar within even the most perfectly sealed and evacuated room or chamber will still have radiant mass energies that will still produce interactive EM fields that will affect the measurement of gravity. So it will still continue via that method to be an inaccurate measurement. What tetrionics can do is, as I said before, we can build up the value from first principles, knowing how many quanta go into any particular material substance. Just see what this one's. The tetrion, to give the final picture of tetrionics as a unified field equation, 6609 is a picture that gives, in this case, element 120 within a spatial coordinate system, and shows all the components that go into the gravitational field of that element, that one atom. You can see that on the left-hand side we have Newton's force law for gravitation with a convergent force acting to the center of the atom. It models the radial vacuum energies that you can see there. In this case, that geometry, almost circular, but it's like a spinning top of element 120, would displace the vacuum energies around it and result in a convergent force. You can see on the right hand side that should the atom be in motion, it would produce a chem field of motion where the energies of motion are stored, and that in turn would create interactive forces, just like a charged object would. If it was an electrostatic force, there would be two chem fields, with the energy momenta of both chem fields cancelling out, creating the static component, but they'd still be charged fields, so they'd still be electrostatic particle that is not in motion. And that's where BEM fields come from. If you were to draw two chem fields, you'd have a BEM. But you can also see on that illustration that through tetrionics, we can show that the charge topology, the 3D matter surface area of element 120 has 10,080 charged fascia. It's a neutral charge. The negative charge fascia balance out the positive charge fascia, and that includes the charge fascia of electrons as well. You can see that it has a specific mass energy that's calculated from the Planck quanta using the tetrionic formulation for, or universal formula, unified formula for matter, which is 4n pi mass omega quanta squared, or Planck quanta squared per c to the fourth. You can see that we can also calculate the energies of the chem field, which produce the forces of interaction, convergent and divergent, as per Coulomb's law. We can calculate them exactly based on the mass energy geometries, which are even pi Planck quanta squared per c squared versus c to the fourth. As we've discussed, they form, where they superposition, they form a c to the fourth squared, a c to the fourth coordinate system. But that picture there gives us a complete quantum model of a atom that is in motion. It gives us the convergent and divergent fields of force that that atom of mass, energy, matter creates within its spatial coordinate system. And that is what we call universal gravitation. Gravitation is both the convergent gravity plus the interactive EM fields of any atom or any collection of atoms. All these energies of mass, all these mass energies can be added up and converted to relativistic energies, and that is what the top right hand RE stands for, relativistic energy, which can be converted directly to Einstein's, same value as Einstein's stress energy tensor. Or as you can see there, we've got the element name and its molar mass as well.
Well, Calvin, this is where people would say QED. It is fascinating how you bring it all together and also bring it down to a fundamental simplicity.
We can do another talk on forces.
Okay, let's conclude this recording for now.
Close this one. Okay.
And then we'll come back. And congratulations, Calvin. Fantastic.